Today on North Coast Digital, we examine the world's smallest disk drive and other storage marvels. We ask, whatever happened to Y2K? And Rich makes friends with Newt Gingrich using Macy's Bridal Registry on the web.
Hello, welcome to North Coast Digital. My name is Rich Wiggins, and as always, I'd like to introduce my partner in crime, Chuck Severance.
Thanks, Rich. Well, it looks like you have a whole pile of widgets that you brought into the studio. So why don't you start off? Show us what you brought.
Well, I have a couple things I want to talk about.
Okay.
First off, you know there was the recent incident at the Los Alamos Labs where hard drives disappeared.
Right.
And they eventually reappeared by a water cooler.
Okay.
But do you know the exact circumstance of those drives, what
no.
was on them?
No.
What it was they had a laptop environment they had built where you could walk around with a briefcase that had basically all of the nuclear secrets of the United States.
Okay.
In case any of our weapons fell into the hands of terrorists. And then what they could do is somebody in the field could go, oh, they've got weapon XYZ. Here's how we deal with that. Here's the ways to disarm it, how to deal with it in the field. And
the training manuals and things like that.
Right.
Okay.
So that got me to thinking that we're all concerned about the loss of these hard drives. Look what I've got in my hand here.
That looks like a flash card.
Look more closely, Charles.
That would be a 340 megabyte micro drive.
This is the
world. When did you get
this? I've got it just a few weeks ago. This is the world's smallest disk drive. It's by IBM.
I heard those were coming out.
And they have recently announced a 1 gigabyte version of this. And it's useful in things like digital cameras and small PDAs. And so
does it make noise?
It consumes energy. It is a real hard drive.
Okay.
And we're going to talk about this quite a bit more later on in the program today.
Nifty. Let me hold on to it. That is pretty cool.
That is a real disk drive.
Well,
moving parts and everything.
Nifty.
What did you bring?
Well, I brought something that's just going to be something I'm going to continuously punish you with from show to show to show. And so,
oh, no.
So I'm going to ask you what that is.
Something that was on sale for $2.
No, that you took the punchline away. What is it?
It's a Y2K device. Oh, it's a hardware fix for Y2K. And you're
yeah.
making fun of me for having had Y2K responsibility.
Big time Y2K guy.
Major
exactly.
Midwestern University.
And so the important thing here is this was originally, I'll put this up, was originally $79.99 and it was marked down to $2. It's a Y2K fix, and of course, you know, there's kind of Y2K was not as exciting.
Well, the year's not over yet, so maybe I'll take this in case anything comes up.
But when I saw that for $2, I immediately thought of you, and I immediately bought it, and so there you go. It's a little memento of sort of $79, $2, the Y2K that wasn't.
Be prepared.
Y3K. I see people, they're putting their dates in /00, right?
Yeah.
So it's going to be a Y3K problem. So
that's right. We're also going to
It's not lazy programmers, it's lazy people.
I got one other item to show
okay.
you, Charles, and this one should amuse you. You know I'm a devoted reader of the New York Times.
Yes. Yes.
You act like that bothers you.
No, it's just I can think of something better to do in a lunch than sit and read the New York Times all day.
There's a columnist for the Times named Maureen Dowd.
Okay.
And she takes on everybody.
Right.
She took on Bill Clinton during the impeachment year, and she's recently taken on Newt Gingrich. And she took him to task for some things about his personal life. And she happened to mention in this column that you could go to Macy's.com and you could buy him a present for his third marriage that's upcoming, still upcoming.
That's pretty slick.
Yeah. So?
So what did you do?
I'm a nerd. I went to Macy's.com.
And what'd you see?
At the Macy's site, I took the name that, you know, we have Mr. Gingrich's name and his betrothed, Callista Disick. And I went and I found the cheapest item that was still available that somebody hadn't already gotten for them.
What would that be?
It's a nice little database here. Well, that happened to be Linux Citation Gold, some sort of a tablespoon.
Linux.
L-E-N-O-X. No, it has nothing to do with an operating system.
Just checking.
Boy, are you really bad with your wedding gifts.
It'd be a good wedding gift, though.
$1,750. They needed two. I bought one. Cheapest person buying for them. Filled in some forms, gave them a credit card number. And lo and behold, I get email back from them saying in a couple of days that we have shipped this item to Ms. Calista L. Bissick of McLean, Virginia, and it has the address. This is kind of an interesting problem here.
So you've whited the address out, of course.
I've whited the address out because any schmuck could go and look it up having read this column.
Right.
And people in general could just start guessing, right? You could say, well, I bet this person probably registered at Saks.
Right.
This person. And so there's a little bit of a privacy issue there.
Yeah.
But then also, to my surprise, you go and you look and try to look up Calista, and Switchboard doesn't list her, neither does it list Ms. Gingrich. So, you know, they were unlisted. But lo and behold, a couple of weeks later, I get a card in the mail.
This would be a card asking you for money from Republican National Committee.
Certainly not the Democratic, because it says, "Dear Richard, thank you for the lovely flatware. Calista and I will use it happily, and think of your kindness, the one tablespoon I gave you. Your friend, Newt."
And it doesn't look like it came out on a laser printer. That is actually kind of amazing.
So the web is a wonderful place, and if you want to get an autograph of a famous person for $20, here's the technique.
Well, that is pretty amazing. That is quite amazing.
Don't lose that.
I won't lose that. There you go.
And with that, we'll be right back.
Recently, I was in Orlando, Florida, and I visited Walt Disney World to see how they're using the web for public relations.
Our site is a business-to-business site designed specifically for the journalists who cover Walt Disney World, and maybe those who only on occasion have the opportunity to cover Walt Disney World. It's one-stop shopping, 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, when our office isn't open, when our publicists aren't available to the journalistic community, and it basically serves up all of our news releases, photography, information about what's hot at Disney, what's news at Disney, and even some background information for those who just need to do some fact-checking and can't get a hold of one of us. You know, the typical customer of our site is the news journalist. It's basically those who cover Walt Disney World as a beat. The team of people that work on our site are basically me, myself, and I. We are, you know, a smaller site. We're not Disney.com, which most people think of when they think of Disney and the Internet or the Go Network. We're a very small, very focused, business-oriented site that, you know, I lead the editorial direction on. I lead the maintenance. We've contracted with a multimedia firm out in California who does all the engineering for the site. We use all of our publicists on our staff and all of the traditional means of communication that we have where we can. And really, sort of my job is to work with the rest of the staff to identify news releases, photographs, video that we use in traditional channels and how those can apply to our site and to the audiences that we reach via the internet. So we haven't cut off our mailings yet, but we definitely are looking at it from a cost savings, but even more so just from a special service. I mean, people think they come down to Walt Disney World and, you know, they expect great guest service in our parks, and we like to think that, you know, even on the business side of things, that we can deliver that same guest service to our customers who are the journalists who, you know, in the end pass on a lot of the messages that we have to pass on to prospective vacationers at Walt Disney World.
So, Rich, what'd you think?
Well, I thought it was really interesting. You know, when we think of Disney, we think of a major media conglomerate.
Sure, Disney.com and
Go.
And
the Go Network, yep. And ownership of ABC and so forth. And so when you think of Disney and the web, you think in terms of really highfalutin web design. And
one of the things that kind of amazed me is, off camera, I sort of asked him what it was like to sort of work in what you think would be a really big organization. And he was given a lot of freedom as to how he did his job and how he used the facilities.
Well, I guess our image of what Disney is and the internals are probably a lot different. What's interesting is I know that Disney will do all kinds of conferences and seminars at Disney World for other businesses, so that other businesses can learn how to emulate the way that they do business.
I think they're a very pragmatic organization. The other thing that was interesting is how they actually produce the websites, right? They use every bit of technology available to them, all the way from Federal Express to FTPing across the country, and they have various subcontractors all over the country. And I think it's really neat to see how a small little operation like the PR group was able to create a nifty website.
Was it your impression that he sort of wished that he had more tools at his disposal, or a high-powered team doing the design, or is he happy with the way it works?
I think he's quite happy with the way it works. I think that it sort of, you know, he was doing his PR job before, and now he's doing his PR job now, and the web is just
another tool. And before he used the fax machine,
yeah,
and the telephone, and the
exactly.
cell phone.
And there's, it's not, he's not dealing with hundreds of thousands of people. He's dealing with the journalists that cover Disney as a beat.
And it's a special kind of communication going on in a new medium.
Exactly.
We'll be right back. Chuck, you know, all the time, people come up to me and say, how do I get my business on the web? I want to set up a server. What are my first steps? What do you think I ought to tell them?
Well, I get that same question. I get the same question in the form of, I'm starting up a business plan, I'm going to go to venture capitalists, and so how much do I put in for the staff to run my web server? And I think I tell them the same thing that you do, and that is, you probably shouldn't run your own web server. Because really...
What a shocking concept, but shouldn't every business be on the web?
Every business should be on the web, at least most business should be on the web, but the problem is that it's 24/7. It's a high-stress situation, and for very little gain. And the problem is I tell them roughly, in the first part of the conversation, I say, oh, you figure about $250,000 a year. And they go, huh?
Some sticker shock when you say that.
$250,000 a year, right? And I say, well, okay, you got about three to four people. I mean, how can you put one poor person on a beeper and leave them on a beeper and have them coming in on Easter and Christmas and all these things? And so you have to have a few people, and what if this person quits? You have to have another set of staff. So I figure, you know, 4 to 5 people. And the alternative, of course, is
rent space on somebody else's server.
Right. And the beauty is, how much is it? Well, maybe $70 a month. And you get as good or better than as if it were your own server, because these people are professionals. They have perhaps 300 or 400 sites, and they give them absolute state-of-the-art software, state-of-the-art backup, and they have 3 or 4 or 5 people always on beepers 24/7.
Now, we should be clear that the kind of company we're talking about here is somebody that will host your content. They will host your site for you. Now, you don't necessarily have to hire the same people to design your site
or
maintain your site.
These people give you a virtual server somewhere as part of their big server, and you could do your own site or hire yet another party. Now, that could be by far the more expensive part
right.
of your website. $70 a month just to host the content is a small change compared to what it costs once you have someone designing the information content, the graphics, et cetera, et cetera.
Now, see, I'll go one step further and say that virtually every business ought to have a website. In fact, a few years ago, I was driving through West Michigan, and I saw one of these old-fashioned signs you used to see by the side of the road with the blinking lights and the marquee.
Yep.
And it was a bait shop, and they had their URL. Since then, I've been wanting to write an essay, does a bait shop need a website?
I think so. I think to some degree. It's the same as a phone number.
But a few years ago, I was thinking, no, but, you know, if somebody's traveling through West or Northern Michigan and they're thinking about a fishing trip, you know, they might look them up.
Or if they just have the name of a place and they want a quick little map how to get off this little tiny back road and get onto the bait shop, absolutely.
And you mentioned $70 a month. There are free hosting sites that are really intended for personal purposes. But if you have a low-volume site, a business that doesn't really need a whole lot of serious web presence, you could even go to GeoCities or one of the other free services.
Right. My problem with that for a business is it just, as soon as someone sees one of those GeoCities-style banner ads, people go, ooh, this must not be
right.
a good business.
Right. And if, for instance, if you were pretending to be a web design company and you had a GeoCities address,
yeah.
I would never hire you. But if you're a bait shop, I'd probably forgive you for going to the cheap hosting.
But then you
bullshit.
Have to have, your billboard has to get bigger, though, because you got WGOCity / whatever. I mean, I want www.bait.com.
You can go to register.com and set up URL forwarding.
And that's
and you
35
can get
bucks a year.
Baitshop.com
right.
and have it point to your GeoCities website. So the bottom line, I think, is that there's a wide range of solutions. And it's really at an extreme that you decide it's necessary for you to run your own server.
Right. And the rule of thumb that I use when you decide to run your own server is if you're going to have a IT organization of 10 to 12 people, then two or three more to run web servers is not such a big deal. But if you're not in a business that requires a large investment in technology, just infrastructure, then you shouldn't try to put up a web server.
No one would build their own car these days.
Exactly.
We have someone else do it. So let's have someone else run our website.
Yep.
We'll be right back.
So, Rich, it looks like you brought a pile of hardware in for Cool Tools. So tell us about it.
Well, we want to talk about this little IBM microdrive that we
yep.
mentioned at the opening of the show.
I'm still amazed at that.
I am too. And so, for perspective, I brought some hard drive history. Here we have a drive that's current vintage. You would put this in a desktop computer.
So that's a 10 or so gigabyte drive?
This one is 12 gigabytes,
yep.
or 1,200 megabytes.
Right.
So in contrast to this little thing, 340 megabytes.
How much was that, by the way?
About $1 a megabyte.
Okay. So that's pretty expensive still.
It's very expensive compared to...
Okay.
So you're paying a premium
sure.
for this small
package. As you would expect.
As you would expect. And I'm sure the 1 gig drive is going to be expensive too, mm-hmm. so it might be $1,000 for all I know.
Right.
So let's compare this to a couple of others, going back in history to the dawn of the web. This is a circa 1993 drive that used to be in a Next workstation.
That looks about like my first 5 megabyte hard drive that I got.
From way back when, going
yeah.
back into the 80s. Well, this one from the early 90s. Holds 760 meg.
So it's about twice.
About twice the capacity of this little thing.
Okay.
And this probably cost, I don't know, $1,000.
$1,000 probably back then,
back
sure.
Then. This was a high-performance drive.
I remember when you could get $1 a megabyte, right?
So that was a big deal. When
that
we
was a big deal.
$1 a megabyte was a
exactly.
big deal. Right.
Yep.
And then now we have a little 12 gig drive that was a few hundred dollars. And this one goes in the internal bay in a laptop, such as this one.
The other thing that's amazing about portable drives is that they're fast now. It used to be that the portable drives were sort of
yes,
significantly slower, and these are just as fast.
Yeah,
the
performance characteristics of this would be pretty similar to
yes.
this, and the capacity of this is pretty similar to this.
Right. And the price in that is not quite as much a premium as it is for that.
No, this would be probably 3 times
right.
or 4 maybe what yeah. you would pay for a desktop one.
And that's because those are becoming much more mass market, because portables are becoming much more mass market.
Exactly. So now let's talk about what's the motivation behind this. Is this just an exercise in IBM showing that they're cool? Well, no, because if you have a digital camera such as this one,
yep.
it comes with a compact flash card, which is the format
right.
of this.
And I have inside here a little 15 megabyte card right now.
Right, and you can get in compact flash, and this is just memory, this is just
yep.
non-volatile memory, you can get up to 128 meg. But the cost per megabyte is getting to be about the same as this.
Right, and there's professionals that are professional photographers, for example, for just photo family snapshots, 15 megabytes might be enough. But if you're a professional and want the highest resolution, you need as much as you can get.
Right, and we're in a world now where there are now 3 megapixel cameras that are available,
right.
which are pretty good, and in a future show we'll talk about those. And you want to be able to get at least as much on a quote roll as you would with a conventional camera.
Right.
With this, you can do it.
Oh, yeah,
you can
absolutely.
Talk about
what you really almost want with a digital camera is quite a bit more than on roll. You want to be able to take 100 pictures without even thinking
right.
about it and throw the ones that you don't want away, and so you need a lot of space.
So the good news is this lets you do it, but what's the bad news?
Bad news is that because you're spinning something physically, it takes more power than this takes, because this
right.
is just a RAM, basically.
This thing really consumes batteries.
So you need a big battery on the bottom of your...
And it was already true...
That batteries
that digital cameras wanted to eat batteries like crazy. So you and I were recently at the Detroit Gold Cup hydroplane races,
right.
and we saw
a professional
photographer with lenses this long
and a battery this big.
And those folks have huge batteries, and this is perfect for them.
Right.
Because every time they have to switch, quote, film.
Now here's the other thing
delay.
That's kind of amazing, because I mean these two things are kind of the same, right? You got this RAM and you got this disk, but this came out in the market much earlier.
Right.
But I have this little USB thing that I'll probably bring in on a future show, where you plug it in. And this appears as a disk drive.
Right.
It has files, it has folders. So they must have known when they started out here that it was going to become a disk drive. So these things are like little virtual disk drives when you plug them into
your computer. Well, I think treating it as a virtual drive is a good metaphor for people. They're used to files and folders and dragging files around and things like that.
Then when you this thing shows up, it's perfectly natural.
It
and
really
so why don't you give me that PCMCI card that you got right there. So if you want to put this into a portable computer, and that's what we've been doing here on the set, is we plug this thing in, and you plug it in like this, and it's sort of better than a floppy drive.
Right.
Because it shows up as your D drive. And you plug it into the PCMCIA slot, and we sit here on the set and go back
and it turns out to be not only a good medium of storage, but a good medium of exchange.
Right.
Very convenient, very fast, very reliable.
As long as you have non-volatile computers.
Yes. If you have a desktop, you're going to have to get, you called it PCMCIA, which is, of course, the old terminology.
Right.
The current terminology is PC card, of course.
Right.
But there's a lot of toys and a lot of options. And over the years, we'll watch and see whether rotating mass storage
will
compete
with
memory.
Static RAM.
We'll be right back. Now let's see what's happening in the news of the net. First, a website has caused someone to land in jail. A high school junior in Utah, Ian Michael Lake, posted vulgar descriptions of his teachers and his classmates on his own personal website. Although no threats were involved, the local sheriff arrested him and seized his computer, and he may be charged with criminal libel, which would be a first on the internet. The University of Illinois has decided to block MP3 downloads. MP3 is the popular music format used by so many students today, and Illinois has blocked access to the Napster.com site, a popular MP3 archive. A UI official said it got to the point that at night, 80% of our network traffic was Napster downloads. Dennis Lee, a junior in engineering in Illinois, says, "It shouldn't be the university's call on what we can and can't access. We paid for this network." The first truly online fashion retailer has collapsed. Boo.com died only 6 months after it was launched. They were unable to attract enough customers to pay for their significant startup costs. They were formed late in 1999 and had offices in London, Paris, and New York. Their founder says, "We have been too visionary." A worm has attacked cell phones. The Spanish provider, Telefonica, found that an email worm was invading thousands of internet-capable cell phones. The worm used a technique similar to the I Love You attack that hit millions of people worldwide. The author was protesting the monopoly service that he claimed this company offered. Experts are predicting that we'll see many more worms like this as cell phones become internet-enabled. Polly want to surf the web? MIT researchers are worried about lonely parrots. They say that parrots are social creatures and that they need stimulus all day long when their owners are away. So research assistant Benjamin Resner trained parrots to surf the web using a joystick controller. Now MIT is working on the InterPet Explorer web browser. Carnivore spurs controversy. The internet service provider Earthlink has revealed the existence of an FBI email snooping program called Carnivore. Carnivore is hardware and software placed on the premises of the service provider that looks through all of the email traffic that flows through the wires of that provider. The FBI says this only takes place under court order and that the software is very specific and only finds the email of the targeted individual named in the court order. What do you think of that, Chuck?
Well, I think sort of it's only a matter of time. I mean, at some point, what we see over time is that those things that happen sort of in the non-internet, non-web world find representations in the real world, like business going out of business and wiretaps. I would imagine at some point there was some effort that went into some court that had to certify this software that it didn't just look at everything that went by.
But it does look at everything because it has to inspect the headers.
Sure.
And the FBI has used the analogy, well, we have to look at every envelope to see if the letter is one that we're authorized to get hold of.
Or another analogy would be when you're wiretapping a wire, you happen to be in the phone closet where all the phone conversations are happening and you just are supposed to tap it, but you could tap the other one.
Yeah, but when you tap that wire, assuming you get the right one, you physically can only listen to the conversation of the target. Here, it's a very simple configuration error, let's say, and You've got millions of customers' email traffic flowing through, and you potentially can look at all of it.
But it wouldn't be admissible in court any more than if you just sneaked in, picked the lock, and
the telephone. I just wanted to keep profiles on a whole bunch of people and find out, you know, who doesn't fit a certain category. You know, you say, well, the FBI would never do that, but in past days, the FBI has done things like this.
No, but the FBI is not supposed to do that any more than they're not supposed to randomly.
Well, let me propose another model.
Okay.
How about the FBI says, Earthlink, Joe Blow is an alleged criminal, and we've got a court order to intercept all of his email. Earthlink, do that for us.
Well,
instead of the FBI putting their equipment on the premises.
I think the problem there would be is how long would Earthlink have to retain materials? What if Earthlink suffered some kind of a failure of their disk drives and they had to back it up?
But in fact, what Carnivore did, according to the folks at Earthlink, is that they could only run it on a certain version of Earthlink's operating system and email software, and they actually had Earthlink had to actually go and back level their software, and they actually had a service outage because of the installation of this thing.
And probably when the FBI built it, they built it on some XYZ technology, and it took them so long to get it working that it was mildly obsolete.
Right, and the bottom line is you don't really want J. Edgar Hoover deciding what level of software you're running.
Right, that you could imagine Carnivore should be able to not require them to change their software.
Yeah, I'm trying to figure out why that would even be true. It seems like if it knows how to read SMTP mail headers, it would just watch the traffic as it goes by and do that.
Well, it might be different versions of SMTP or some more advanced things like IMAP and various other things. Maybe they had to go back to POP or something like that.
Well, that was our serious subject, but the really serious subject is, what do you think about those parrots surfing the web?
Well, I had to crack a little bit of a smile on that, although it's kind of interesting because at some point it's this visual stimulus, and they're doing something, and it changes, and it's sort of no different than some green circle coming up. I'm not sure what the scientific question being asked there is.
But I was thinking, you know, with real-time cameras, you could have parrots interacting with other parrots.
Oh, that's a good point.
You know, they've got these.
But I bet they would
videotapes that you show your cat. You know, birds flying by, and the cat just sits there staring at the.
So the interesting thing would be, would the parrot tolerate the blocky video? Right, say that looks like a parrot, but it's blocky video, and the squawk has got bad quality, and I got bad interactive delay, and they might just say, I want a real telephone conversation with this parrot.
Well, parrots are social creatures, but I don't know that they can articulate quite that much.
The other story you talked about that was interesting is the Napster one. And I think what that demonstrates is there's kind of a new generation of people coming on the Internet. And the original Internet, everybody kind of knew we were in it together, and one for all and all for one. And
almost a socialist, a utopian environment.
A utopian environment where I knew that if I was wasting something, I was taking it away from you and I cared about you.
Yeah, there was almost a campground mentality of leave it better than when you arrived.
Exactly. Yeah. And so I sense from the student that was quoted there that this next generation says it's all for me.
I own all of this bandwidth.
I want it for me and I don't care what happens to you. And I think that's going to change some of the economics of the Internet.
I think absolutely so. The thing that hits me the hardest about this is the tool Beamit.
Yep.
Where I can take my own CD and beam it up to a server, allegedly, and then I can listen to it anywhere, and it's a total waste of bandwidth.
Well, we'll have to talk about that some other time.
Okay.
Because we're about out of time.
All right. We'll see you on the net.